Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, Malaysia says the two men on board a missing flight with stolen passports had no links to terrorism. Japan marks the third anniversary of its tsunami and nuclear disaster, and the Philippines prepares for its first rice harvest since Typhoon Haiyan. Those stories and more on VOA's Crossroads Asia. The head of Interpol says the disappearance of a Malaysian passenger jet does not appear to be related to terrorism. Interpol Secretary General Ronald Noble says new information about two Iranian men who used stolen passports to board the plane makes terrorism a less likely explanation for the jet's disappearance. The International Police Agency released photos showing the two boarding the plane at the same time. Bill Ide reports from Beijing that searchers still have found no evidence today of where the plane went down.
Malaysian authorities say they believe 19-year-old Iranian Pariah Nur Mohammad Mirdad was seeking asylum in Germany. Malaysian Police Chief Khalid Abu Bakar spoke to reporters in Kuala Lumpur.
If you ask me, how do I know that he wants to migrate to Germany? Because we are in contact with his mother. Okay? His mother is expecting him to arrive in Frankfurt. When he doesn't arrive, he contacted us here. And then that's why we knew that he's the one.
Khalid says the man's mother knew he was traveling on a stolen passport. He did not comment on the identity of the other passenger also traveling with stolen documents. Meanwhile, an extensive review of all of those on board continues. Khalid says authorities are looking into four possible scenarios in connection with the plane's disappearance: hijacking, sabotage, personal disputes, and the psychological condition of all of those on board.
There may be somebody there on the flight who has bought huge sums of insurance, who wants the family to gain from it. Or somebody who has owed somebody so much money and, you know. Yeah, we are looking into all possibilities, I say.
As relatives and friends of passengers wait for word on the fate of the flight in the Malaysian capital and in Beijing, many were holding on to hope. The wife of Malaysia's prime minister visited with families in the Malaysian capital. In Beijing, families were anxious for any sign of progress, says one woman surnamed Wang, a daughter of one of the missing passengers. Wang says that for family members who lost contact with their relatives, the most pressing issue is to find out where they are and what happened. She says that if the search and rescue is not yielding any results, they hope that authorities increase their efforts into the investigation of the possibility the plane was hijacked. As many hoped for the best, they were also prepared for the worst. Salamat is the father of flight MH370 passenger Maud Karul Amri. He says, "We hope to see whether he is alive and in good condition, or whatever the outcome, we accept." Authorities from China have handed over photos of all 153 Chinese nationals on board the flight. China is stepping up its efforts to help aid in the search for the missing plane as search efforts pushed into its fourth day. Beijing has redeployed satellites to help in the search for the Boeing 77 jet that vanished from radar screens early Saturday morning. Nine countries have joined the search effort, which once again was expanded on land and sea Tuesday. Search efforts are focusing on waters off the east and west of the Malaysian Peninsula. U.S. naval vessels have joined the search in the Gulf of Thailand, and a P-3C Orion anti-submarine and surveillance aircraft is aiding the search over waters off the west of Malaysia, in the northern Straits of Malacca and the Andaman Sea. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Well, watching for any information about the missing plane is French freelance journalist Eric Meyer, who has spent many years in Beijing and knows some of the passengers who were aboard flight MH370. VOA's Jim Stevenson spoke with Meyer in the Chinese capital.
She was the mother of two teenagers. They had been for 1 week of school leave in Malaysia. This, in Beijing, we do very often. You take the plane and go to Malaysia or go to Philippines or go to Thailand, and then you are in the sun, and you are at the beach, and you have a good time. And then you take your plane back to Beijing, where you're in the cold and in the pollution, and then you start your real life again. I mean, but in that case, she had taken her two teenagers, and the girlfriend of her boy, who was in the same school, and who was French as well, Franco-Chinese. So she was responsible of three kids, and all of them have disappeared now with that plane, with the 239 passengers and crew members. The drama in their case is that the father is working for this cement company, Lafarge. So he was on his new assignment in Paris in December. And because the kid was at the French school, and it was his, the older of the two, it was his last year before the final examination and before university. So they decided to stay in Beijing to avoid the disruption and to a hazard for the final exam of the boy. If they had come back to Paris, they would be alive now. And the father was on another plane from France exactly at the same time to come to Beijing to visit them. They were supposed to meet at that time. So the father is here now.
This incident, of course, follows the railway stabbings in Kunming. What is the mood in Beijing like overall?
The Chinese are very scared. You can see new things, but to what do you attribute them? Of course, the Chinese authorities are determined not to tolerate any new mishap during the parliament. Yesterday, I saw two kind of new vehicles, a sort of jeep with the police people. It was a police jeep, but without a roof. And the policemen had machine guns. And I saw also men on abnormal crossroads in the street of Beijing with a sort of stronger machine gun than... you don't see policemen with machine gun in Beijing. You see them with truncheons or maybe a small revolver on the side. But the arm was different.
Eric Meyer, freelance journalist in Beijing. He spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, the Taliban threatens Afghan voters. Japanese mark the third anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster today. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Emperor Akihito took part in a Tokyo commemoration marking the precise time of 2:46 p.m. local time when a massive 9.0 magnitude earthquake rocked northeast Japan, causing the 10-meter high tsunami. The Fukushima disaster, known as 311, devastated the country's northeast in 2011, leaving more than 18,500 dead or missing. An estimated 250,000 people still live in temporary housing. Three reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant melted down, releasing massive amounts of radioactive material. The plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, is trying to control a rapid buildup of radioactive water while decommissioning the plant, which could take up to 40 years. At the Tokyo ceremony, Mr. Abe said Japan's ancestors overcame many troubles and much suffering, but emerged stronger than before. He pledged to work to meet whatever challenges may face the Japanese people. Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston in Tokyo tells VOA's Victor Beatty, 3 years after the disaster, the Japanese people remain in a state of shock, and the twin natural and man-made disasters, which were Fukushima, have had a huge impact on the nation's psyche.
I guess people probably didn't imagine that there'd still be more than 250,000 people displaced. events of 3 years ago. Most people are disappointed with the pace of rebuilding. A vast majority of people think it's going way too slow and the government needs to do more to push it forward. And I guess there's probably some concern about the upcoming Olympics being hosted in Tokyo for 2020, and the preparations for that will divert attention away from the plight of the displaced people of Tohoku. I think clearly one of the big issues facing Japan is nuclear energy. And last night they had a poll conducted by the national television broadcaster and found that only 22% of Japanese actually support restarting the reactors. Just a couple of weeks ago, they did a poll in the communities that actually host the reactors. And less than 10% of those hosting communities said they would favor bringing the reactors back online even after the Nuclear Regulation Authority vouched for their safe operations. Clearly, there's still a lot of skepticism about the wisdom of operating nuclear power plants in one of the most seismically prone countries on the planet.
Monday, Mr. Abe said Tokyo was only halfway done in rebuilding. Is that an understatement?
The rebuilding along the Tohoku coastline, parts of it have made a lot of progress. They've cleaned up all the debris. They've cleared away the half-destroyed buildings. I think there's a lot of doubt whether, in fact, they are going to rebuild. I think they're going to relocate and concentrate some of these small, isolated fishing communities. The larger cities are making faster progress. But the key thing is that there is a serious exodus of younger people, which raises questions about the viability of these coastal communities. And a lot of younger people find no jobs there, no hope there, and they're moving out. So this is going to complicate the matters in terms of providing public services, providing education, maintaining hospital services. All of these things are extremely difficult. So it's really hard to say whether they're halfway there or 40% or 60%. Clearly, anybody who visits the region sees that the devastation lingers, and this place is very far from recovery.
Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo. Michael Kuchek, research associate for the Tokyo-based MIT Center for International Studies, tells Victor Beatty despite strong public opposition to restarting idle nuclear power plants, Mr. Abe and his ruling Liberal Democratic Party see the plants as an economic necessity.
Mr. Abe has tremendous loyalty in his LDP, his Liberal Democratic Party. And if he and his advisors think that it is suitable for Japan to have at least a significant amount, if not the original amount of nuclear power generation back online, they're going to go for that. These nuclear reactors have to meet new, much tougher standards. Basically, Japan is burning through its checkbook to buy fossil fuels around the world at very high prices, which are jacked up precisely because Japan has no choice. In the last month, the figures came out yesterday, the biggest capital account deficit in Japan's history. We have a huge trade deficit, also mostly due to the increase in consumption of fossil fuels trying to replace the lost generating capacity at Fukushima. That's the state of the nuclear debate. There are going to always be people who are going to be fearful of radiation. There are always going to be people who are fearful of the nuclear power plants coming back online. But the truth of the matter is that the government has the votes to do it. It has the need to do it. And in terms of the radiation levels, at least in the Fukushima region, when the prime minister says, "I'm eating Fukushima rice," he has every reason to, except for a very small area near the plants and then stretching to the northwest along the way the wind was blowing on the day of the reactors blew. Life is returning to very much to normal.
Michael, what is the status, the popularity of alternative sources of energy like wind power or solar energy? Is that catching on in Japan?
It's catching on in a big way. There are lots of companies involved in solar. A lot of solar panels are going up on the roofs of houses. They're working in biomass. They're working very significantly in wind, probably in offshore wind farms. So it's going to be a far more heavily renewables mix than it was. Unfortunately, renewables, even if being developed as they are at a breakneck pace, are not going to make a significant contribution to nations' generating capacity for many years. There's not enough productive capacity in the world of solar panels, probably, for the real demand if Japan really went into this.
Michael Kuchek in Tokyo. Meanwhile, Japanese officials continue to grapple with radioactive water at Fukushima used to keep the three melted reactors cool. More than 400,000 tons of such water is being contained in hundreds of storage tanks, and TEPCO is trying to build an underground ice wall to prevent further leakage. Australian Richard Bronowski, who has written the book out Fallout from Fukushima, cautions the crippled plant will continue to pose a dangerous challenge to Japan.
Yes, they're beginning to try this ice containment of the groundwater, but to my mind, it's very much just a temporary measure. The fact is that there's no way of keeping the destroyed reactor cores cool except by keeping pumping water into them. That water immediately becomes radioactive and it has to go somewhere. And they can't just keep building more and more tanks to put it in. It has to go somewhere. It does inevitably leak through the groundwater out into the sea or into other areas of surrounding countryside. That's an ongoing problem. It's probably the most chronic problem, Victor, but in my mind, it's not the most serious. The most serious continues to be how on earth to take the decayed uranium rods that are in the reactor core pool in reactor number 4. It's a very perilous operation. It has been suggested that if that pool containment fell over and the wind was going in the wrong direction, there's enough radiation there to cause the evacuation or the partial evacuation of Tokyo.
3 years on, is the cleanup operation at Fukushima about where you expected it to be?
Yes, and that is, it's got nowhere, I'm afraid. I don't see it as a cleanup operation that's moving forward. I see it as an operation that's trying to plug the gaps in the dike. The thing is unrelenting. It keeps on happening. There continues to be more radiation leaking from these reactors, and it won't stop the foreseeable future because there have been three meltdowns of hundreds of tons of highly radioactive material, and that simply won't go away. The temperature will remain very high, and the chances of more of it leaking are there. So it's not progress, it's containment. And they seem at this stage to be losing the fight. May I say, though, that the Japanese are one of the most, I think, ingenious people in the world. And if anyone can find solutions to contain this dreadful problem, the Japanese can.
Richard Bronowski says Fukushima has had a chilling effort on the nuclear industry in Asia, with South Korea among the few nations committed to nuclear power and exporting nuclear energy technology to other countries. Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency has warned Afghans against participating in the April 5th presidential election and ordered its fighters to use all force possible to disrupt the election. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad. The Islamist group's statement marks its first formal threat of violence to prevent the election process.
The upcoming presidential election is considered key to Afghanistan's stability after the NATO-led coalition ends its combat mission in December. The poll would mark the country's first democratic transfer of power. But security remains the biggest challenge facing the democratic process, and the Taliban threat is likely to fuel those fears. A Taliban statement Monday condemned the election as an American conspiracy, urging Afghans to completely reject it and not put themselves in danger by going to the polls. It said Taliban fighters have been ordered to disrupt the sham elections by full force and attack election workers, activists, volunteers, and those providing security. The head of the Free and Fair Elections Foundation of Afghanistan, Jandad Spingar, says such threats undermine the election process and scare away voters.
It's now belong to the Afghan government, especially security institution, to respond to such statement, not just by a statement, but by some certain efforts and measures which make sure that Taliban cannot disturb the election. Otherwise, of course, it will affect on people, especially psychologically, on people's thoughts about their participation.
Dozens of people were killed during the fraud-riddled 2009 election that returned incumbent President Hamid Karzai to power. Election laws bar him from running for a third consecutive term. Militant attacks in the past month have killed two campaign workers, and presidential front-runner candidate Abdullah Abdullah has escaped an assassination attempt. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the violence. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Some farmers in the central Philippines are preparing for their first rice harvest since last November's powerful super typhoon swept away their fields and homes and killed more than 6,200 people. From Basay, Samar, Simone Orendine reports.
Florencio de la Cruz says he had harvested 6 tons of rice less than 2 weeks before Super Typhoon Haiyan's howling winds blew off his storehouse roof and brought soaking rain. The sun helped dry some of the harvest, and he was able to recover a little. Then, late last year, de la Cruz received rice seeds from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. The organization helped start the planting season in this part of the country where more than two-thirds of the population lives in poverty. De la Cruz says nothing would have happened without the seed program because they lost all their crops and even their house. De la Cruz expects to reap the new crop on March 28th. He has been farming rice on a one-hectare patch of land for more than 50 years. His family is among the 44,000 that the Food and Agriculture Organization says has so far been helped by the seed program. Late last year, officials said 63,000 hectares of rice had to be replanted after Haiyan struck. Philippine officials say the FAO contributed 52% of the required seeds, while the international community added another 28%, and the rest came from the government. They say after Typhoon Bopa struck the southern Philippines in 2012, the government's seed stock was depleted. On Monday, FAO Director General Graciano da Silva inspected the seed program in Basay Municipality, where de la Cruz lives. He says the farmers are receiving certified quality seeds, which should bring greater yields than what they have now. But he says this first batch of seeds was rushed out in less than ideal conditions.
Remember that the typhoon came exactly in the moment that was close in the time, let's say, for another planting. And we need to do it in a week, 2 weeks. And we did it. The most important that the result would be zero if we not provide those.
Da Silva says under the circumstances, the response from the international community and other agencies in the Philippines was one of the quickest he has seen. He says the next step is to make sure the farmers get a fair price for their rice crops and that this would spur them to plant even more. Agencies are also trying to recover the 33 million coconut trees that they say the typhoon obliterated. Philippine Agriculture Department officials say on Thursday, a massive coconut clearing operation will get underway throughout the typhoon-stricken region. The goal is to get the trees replanted, which will then need at least 4 years to mature and bear fruit. In the meantime, they plan to help coconut farmers plant fast-growing crops like cassava and white corn. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Basay, Samar Province, the Philippines.
Hopefully better times ahead for the Philippines. Well, please look at our website. You can get to it at voanews.com. We have a range of stories that might interest you. We also have some television spots as well. Also, if you're on Facebook, take a look at our Facebook page. It is VOA Asia. Thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki coming up next.